Spiegel and Holmes. Afternoons on the Score.
Did we see what was up your sleeve? Did you use it? Or
I don't know. What's up yours?
Jason Leisure is kicking Matt Eberflus's ass.
I don't know if I really look at it that way, Jay.
Jason Leisure.
I'm here in the studio at the Score. This is a very, very special honor for you.
You are right about miserable Jason Leisure. He joins us now.
I feel like Stu Gatz doesn't really like this segment.
I think you're great. I think you're miserable.
The one thing that you and I have in common is that we both don't like this segment.
There's reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times.
You want to believe that they're telling you the truth and what they're saying is straightforward, but that, of course, isn't how it works here.
Jason Leisure.
Jason?
Matt, I have two questions for you about Caleb. Do you think his progress is viewed differently because of the expectations that not only everyone has had on him for the last few years, back to when he was a college player, but the expectations that he set for himself, saying before the draft, even saying he was going to, you know, his goal was to exceed C.J. Stroud's rookie season, for example.
Expectations are always going to be out there, and they are an outside-in type of force, and he's got to really do a good job. We have to do a really good job of working from the inside out. That's where I think he is, and that's where I think we need to be.
Jason Leisure with Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score.
Jason Leisure does an incredible job of covering the Bears for the Chicago Sun-Times, and we appreciate him joining us on the Spiegel and Holmes show. Mr. Leisure, how are you?
I'm good. I like the new intro. Is that Shane?
It's Tanny.
Yes, no, it's Tanny. Definitely okay. Me, Jason. I do all the sounds.
Here's the deal.
Okay, all right. I'm just still learning how this show goes.
Since you asked, Jason, Tanny does all the sound and gets all the credit from people on air. But every morning at 7 a.m., Shane texts Tanny detailed instructions on everything he should do. That's just the truth.
Okay. So Shane tells him how to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mitch tells me, and then I tell Tanny.
Okay. The Levitard clip that you guys played in there reminded me of something I hadn't thought about in a long time. My last show down there in Miami, the last thing that Stu Gatz said to me as I was leaving was "good riddance," which was funny because he thought he was saying something nice. He thought he was saying like "happy trails." He didn't know that was an insult on the way out the door.
That is amazing, but also 100% Stu Gatz. Like that, yes, that, right. That completely makes sense for
yeah. Good riddance, buddy. Have a good riddance.
What he's into. Mr. Leisure, I want to ask you a question about the Bears and what happens on game day. I want to start there.
Okay.
When Matt Eberflus took over the job, one of the things that he said is that you don't want to be a CEO head coach. I don't want to call plays. Now, everything shifted because there were firings and all sorts of other stuff that went on with the Bears coaching staff. I'm a little surprised that we are still in a place where you can really quibble with whether or not he's in charge of the sidelines 3 years in. Is it fair to wonder that?
It's totally fair. And I can tell you he hates every time I ask him about this. I can tell. Because one of the things I did like about the Matt Eberflus hire was his plan of being the overarching CEO-style coach, not having it set up like it was under Matt Nagy, where you have Nagy is basically head coach of the offense, and Vic or Sean Desai or Pagano or whoever is head coach of the defense. And then it's like, well, the head coach, no matter what his specialty is, he can get fired for the other side of the ball being bad too. And that is something that has been a challenge that has been put to Matt Eberflus since the day he was introduced. And his plan of, well, I'm going to have all these guys under my umbrella. I'm going to hire a defensive coordinator who's going to run things. And I'm going to hire an offensive coordinator who's going to run things. And then I will be able to divert my time as needed to wherever more help is needed and be able to focus a lot on game days. Between all the things you have to keep track of on game days, Lawrence, I really don't know why more coaches don't go this route of trying to be the CEO style coach and have someone else calling plays offensively and defensively, because you're trying to keep track of injury situations. You're trying to keep track of is our play calling on the other side of the ball working right, or do I need to intervene, or do I need to give some guidance, timeouts, challenge flags, going for two, onside kick. There's so many different things that you have to keep track. Are we going to go for it on fourth and one coming up here? I mean, you have to be thinking ahead constantly. And that's a lot to keep track of while you're also calling the offense or defense. Now, obviously, a bunch of people have done it well. but it just seems more functional to me to have other people calling your offense and defense and be able to jump in when needed. And the part where we keep having friction when I keep asking Matt Eberflus about this over the last 2 years is the offense needs a lot of help. So are you putting in extra time during the week with the offense? Yes. Okay, so are you delegating some things to your defensive coordinator in order to do that? No. So somehow, you know, we go from 50% of our time on defense, 50% of our time on offense to now 50% of our time on defense and 70% of our time on offense. That doesn't work.
Jason Leisure here on Spiegel and Holmes. You know, the game management stuff, a story Pat Manley told me last week, been rolling around my head, that Brad Maynard and Dick Geron developed a relationship back in the day where Maynard would walk around with Dick Geron, and when it was fourth down or when it was time to make a game management choice, Maynard was Geron's friend. And then when Geron left and it was Lovie, Brad Maynard tried to do that with Lovie Smith, and Lovie said, Brad, what are you doing here? Get out of here. Walk away, please. And so, you know, eventually we get to where we are now, which is, I think, every team has somebody on headset with the head coach that is thinking about this stuff, whether it's an analytics person or whether it's a strategy person. And we know that the Bears have somebody on headset who advises Matt Eberflus. So as I think about the 13-play, 70-yard, 7-minute drive that culminates in that touchdown to make it 14-9, is the problem that that person isn't aggressive enough with Matt Eberflus in telling him to be ready for two? Or is the problem that Matt Eberflus is not listening and on point and telling Richard Hightower to not send the freaking kick team out there, making sure Caleb doesn't celebrate if it's his first touchdown pass? And so what is the problem to the best of your knowledge?
Well, I don't know the specific mechanics of that problem right now, but I do know that one way or another, whichever scenario you laid out, whatever one of those or some combination of the two is true, Matt, that goes to Matt Eberflus. That is his problem. And that is a key. We were all in the press box in Indy saying, why are they kicking? Why are they kicking right now? It was an obvious time to go for two. And that is not on Caleb Williams and Roma Dunze. They were of the belief that they were kicking. And that's not their call to make, whether they're kicking or not. But that it's just one of the things that you have to be on top of in this game. And I mean, just the job of managing a game is so much work. I don't know if you guys like to follow these people on Twitter, like Seth Walder at ESPN, who's got the constant equation of, you know, whether you get a greater percent chance of winning by going for it on a fourth down or not, or going for two or not. All of that stuff, like, it's easy for somebody to keep track of that from their house when they're not worrying about calling the offense or calling the defense or, you know, do I need to challenge that last play? The game management stuff is so much work. And we have not seen now in the third year, we have not seen that Matt Eberflus is an expert in that.
Lawrence, I think it's 100% on Flus, like Jason is saying, regardless, to have set up the chain of command and be in charge of that and have everybody be on top of it. And the fact that he's a CEO coach, even more so. And it's inexcusable for something like that to happen at this point in his career.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing to continue to see happen when you're talking about a coach who's in the third year of this. And while there have been a lot of cosmetic changes to Matt Eberflus, and I do think that you can pinpoint some things that he can do well as a head coach, I think he relates well to the players themselves. And I think that he does a good job of calling defenses. But that really isn't the job title of the head coach, is it, Jason? Where no. That's what we're looking at?
No, he calls a great defense. That was something we hadn't known. We hadn't seen concrete evidence of what he was good at until he took over calling the defense last year. We said, oh, okay. Boom. There's proof. He's really good at that. Would a lot of teams hire Matt Eberflus as their defensive coordinator tomorrow? Probably. He's really good at that. He's been good at that for a long time. That's a different job, man. This is a bigger job than that.
Jason, Coleman Shelton pointing the finger on the play call on fourth and goal, whether he's right or not, is a bad look. Jalen Johnson with us yesterday in the 4 o'clock hour, saying that players got to be careful and kind of watch their egos. And he wasn't talking about Shelton, but he was talking about in general, players got to watch their egos and make sure that you listen to the coaches. Like, this feels like a tenuous time for players to kind of turn a little bit. It's early in a season, but do you feel like we're at a tenuous moment for that kind of thing?
I think they're at a point, Matt, where they need to take control of things. I felt like that was the case last week. And last week you had it start to bubble up. And if you remember back to last year when things were really going sideways for them in September, this isn't quite at that level at all. But you were coming off a game where you went down to Houston, held them under 20 points and couldn't win. You have Matt Eberflus challenging plays that we can all see shouldn't be challenged. You have DJ Moore with some bad body language that gets picked up by NBC throughout the broadcast. You have Caleb Williams kind of caught in one of these just social media viral video nonsense things after the game with CJ Stroud. And it felt a lot like things were starting to bubble up. And could the Bears tamp this down, take control of things, say, no, we're not going down that path. And I did see DJ Moore do that. I saw DJ Moore handle his part of that equation and say, yeah, that was, you know, exaggerated. That was a little much when I saw it on camera. I'm going to be supportive of Caleb. That was great. But I think now you add to more of the real things that matter, the real problems, like that Caleb and Stroud video that went all over Twitter is not a real problem. That game losing to that team in Indianapolis that looks like they can't beat anybody, and you go down there and lose 21-16, that's a real problem because you're losing games in the easy part of your schedule now. And this is a team, and this is why the tension is already high, I think, three games in. This is a team that was dead sure that it was going to be a playoff team this year. And it very well might get back in the mix for that and then finish one game out and look back and say, oh, man, that game in Indianapolis when we could only score 16 points, that killed us.
Green Bay's doing what they're doing. Detroit is doing what they're doing.
Minnesota's doing what they're doing.
The Vikings are 3-0. The Bears are somewhere between 26 and 28 in power rankings that came out today.
Yeah, that's not a good look for them overall. And Speaks brought it up when he's talking about some of the issues with Coleman Shelton in the offensive line. I really like Ryan Poles. I think that he has shown that when it comes to having a big vision about what things can be, and I don't know how you can say anything bad about him when it comes to the trade that allowed them, put them in the position to get Caleb Williams and Roma Dunze and beyond, and Tyreek Stevenson and everyone else. But when you look at him and you look at some of the tough decisions that have to be made, should there be any concern that he might be too nice of a guy to end up with this being as successful as he wants it to be?
There is a lot that tells you that he's not really the most cutthroat GM. And this is a cutthroat environment. And I think he really, really likes Matt Eberflus. And I think that factored in as a person. And I think that factored in to the decision to keep him and some loyalty to Matt Eberflus for being the guy that goes out there 3-4 days a week back in 2022 when they're a disaster, when they're 3-14, one of the worst seasons in their history, and the defense is the side that's just getting destroyed. Eberflus's pride and expertise and everything, and his team's out there giving up 30 points a game. I think that Justin Fields got favorable treatment that not a lot of GMs would give him as far as turning down a slightly better offer of where to trade him than what they ended up doing. And I think that it's a real test for Ryan Poles to make hard decisions. This is true for any GM on guys that he drafted. And the guys that are coming to mind for me right now, when I say that, just right off the top of my head, Velus Jones and Braxton Jones, where they are so pleased with the personnel, the player development success story of Braxton Jones. And it is a success story. That is great if you can find a guy in the fifth round in Southern Utah and make him a viable left tackle. But you need more than viable. And you look at their offensive line right now, it's a lot. You're asking for a lot of trust. You got one premium asset there, and it's the number 10 pick that you spent on Darnell Wright. Everyone else, there's question marks.
So they were better in pass pro. I'm not sure exactly what they changed, and we don't get to really talk to Waldron until Thursday. It's I hate that, by the way, about the schedule.
Me too.
Don't you? The schedule of availability. I feel like by Thursday, Shane Waldron's off the hook for a lot of stuff that already happened.
I mean, by Wednesday, I'm not really thinking so much about the previous game, and I'm not looking to relitigate. I mean, that is what we do on Thursdays.
Yeah.
But I'm not really looking to relitigate something from 5 days ago as much as I'm really more putting my attention on the next game. Some teams don't do it that way, by the way. Mm-hmm. Some teams have their coordinators talk on Monday.
Well, you know, the fact that the quarterback talks on Sunday after the game and again on Wednesday, move him to Thursday and move the coordinators to Wednesday at the very least. That would seem to be a natural flop. But I wonder why pass pro was better. And obviously the run blocking was really bad, but maybe it's more on scheme. Like, where are you on figuring out how much of the run game problems or are there talent of the offensive line or game planning and scheming that doesn't seem to be super intuitive, at least when we watch it?
I look right to Shane Waldron because there for 2 years, there was only one thing that the Bears could do and it was run. And so much of that personnel is back. This offensive line, I thought going into the season, would be middle of the pack, which would be okay. They've not been that. They've been below that right now. But there's a lot of carryover in personnel on that offensive line from the group that was first or second in the league in rushing the last 2 years. And then supposedly an upgrade in DeAndre Swift. And I think he is an upgrade. I don't think DeAndre Swift just forgot how to be a 1,000-yard Pro Bowl back. Shane Waldron has got to figure this out. He has undone one of the things they were good at.
So are you not allowed to bring iced tea into the building anymore? And I don't mean the rapper slash actor. I guess technically now the actor slash rapper. But is that a thing now that you can't bring your favorite drink into the game?
I don't know if I can bring iced green tea or iced tea, the actor, because now they have all this facial recognition security to get into the stadiums. And if he hasn't gone through the proper channels and applied for a credential, he's not getting in there. He's not getting up in the press box.
Yeah. So the facial recognition, I heard about this, that they're doing at games now. That's true for Hallis Hall.
I'm talking about the stadiums. Okay. I'm talking about the stadiums. I think Ice-T would be welcome at Hallis Hall.
Okay. But so what happened with you and Ice-T?
Well, I drink ice cream all the time from Starbucks, and if you've ever seen it in these clear cups, I will grant you it does have the coloration of beer. So I do get asked quite a bit by security guards about that, but unless I'm drinking my beer with ice and a straw, I don't see how you could confuse this for something. But I get asked all the time, and you're allowed to bring stuff in. I mean, I'm there to work, so I'm not like a fan. It's like bringing your lunch to wherever you work. It you should be able to bring in whatever you want. And every stadium in the league except Ford Field says fine. Even to the Super Bowl, you're allowed to do that. At Ford Field, I explained that to the security guard a couple of years ago, and his response was, well, this is Detroit. And I don't know what that means, but I guess they're very suspicious of ice green tea in Detroit. But anyway, I got stopped with it going into this Lucas Oil Stadium on Sunday in Indy. And this guy was, you know, those guys that are just, and I guess if you're a security guard, you should take your job really seriously. But this guy was taking it 10% more seriously than that. And he immediately questioned whether it was beer. And I've been asked this so many times that I assume people are goofing with me at this point. And so I said, yeah, it's a beer. And he didn't get that was, it didn't register at all. He goes, oh, well, then you cannot bring that in here.
That's on you. That's on you. It's like making the explosive joke at the TSA. You can't do it. You think you're being clever, like, well, it's just a bomb there.
I thought I was being friendly. I wasn't trying to be funny. I was trying to be friendly, which is, you know, something I'm working on.
I think that you're doing an excellent job.
I don't know. I think he's right. I think it's not a strength, necessarily.
Read Jason Leisure in the Sun-Times. We are thankful that he was available to us on the Spiegel and Holmes show. Thank you so much. We will talk to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Congrats on the new show.
Thank you, Jason.
I adore that guy.
Self-awareness is important. He knows that friendly is not in the wheelhouse. That's okay. You got to know these things.
And he's actually quite friendly, but that's a whole nother story for another day. The fourth and goal from the one has been talked about a lot. I want to talk about it some more, but in a bigger picture context. Can we talk a little bit of short yardage and the short yardage problem in the NFL?
Sure.
Let's do that next. Spiegel and Holmes on the Score.
Spiegel and Holmes.
Good vibes, baby.
Afternoons on the Score. Oh, no.
Williams pitches it to Swift. Swift in trouble. Down he goes. And the Colts hold. The Colts offense
got burned on an option play last week. And this week, the Colts defense shuts down an option run.
Absolutely hate the play call. The play call is hard because when you get penetration in an option, it immediately forces the quarterback to be not a part of the play.
Well, Atiki, there was no edge over there. It was just a guard and tackle, and Indy already had two defenders outside. So it was completely, it was so easy for them to defend that play and get a guy on a guy.
That was a 12-yard loss.
Highlights courtesy of CBS. As we mentioned yesterday, I thought that broadcast was really strong. I know that that's not the A team that was out there, but I thought it was really strong when it came to them actually reacting to the plays and talking about the big moments in a way that isn't just them being like, oh, an actual breakdown of what went wrong on that play.
When it's a three-person booth with two analysts and you have people from opposite sides, like there you got a corner and a running back. Both twins, by the way.
I didn't think of that until a texter brought it up yesterday.
One of two McCourties, one of two Barbers.
It never even crossed my mind. And a texter was like, wasn't it cool that there were the guys that are both twins in the booth? I was like, oh, yeah.
But I feel like at its best, a three-person booth, the two analysts push each other to be smarter and ask questions and go a little further. It's kind of like when there's a catcher and a pitcher together in a baseball booth when AJ and Smoltz were together and they were kind of pushing each other conversationally in some playoff games. I'm a fan of the three-person booth when the two people are different and have different backgrounds and push each other.
And I thought that Catalan did a good job of setting them up to, like, just saying, okay, let my guys do the work inside of this.
Dan, you guys are missing the biggest thing with Catalan is he is part of a set of octuplets in his family. So
he had a
really
TLC
weird
show, right? His parents are John and Kate.
Growing up Catalan.
Plus eight.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, also Mormon.
Yeah.
Those things are probably not true.
No, they're all true.
So there's nine identical siblings among those three broadcasters. Just did the math. Seven of them.
Nope. Nope.
Nope.
Nine
plus the three of them is 12.
It'd be 12.
Yeah, it'd be 12.
Well, you said nine. Well, you said there's nine identical siblings amongst the three of them.
He wasn't counting the three in the booth.
All right, then your verbiage was off, Danny.
It was a semantics problem.
Yeah, I mean, he got sibling. That's it. Sometimes fraternal, sometimes identical.
Leave Danny alone?
First of all, no.
We love Danny.
But second of all, we do need to set a limit. I think one per hour. Tanny, can you be the arbiter of this?
You did say segment, right? One per segment? I'm on board with that, yeah.
I love Danny, but it's a good, fun impression.
Tanny, just cut I love Danny and send that to him.
Although, I just talked to some staffers here inside the Score. They like it. They dig it. Every time we take a shot at Danny, they dig it.
Well,
Robbie Triano.
As long as they don't talk to the Sun-Times, we're good.
Spiegel and Holmes, lunch ball. That's what we like to call
lunch
this
ball
show. That's what we do.
Where's Carton?
Truly, though, the show he's doing is good. They're doing a really good job.
He's doing a great job on
who?
Breakfast Ball.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really good show. I enjoy it.
They have good
chemistry.
I'm
watching sports TV in the morning. I don't do that.
Yeah, no. Well, you shouldn't.
Well, he's our guy, and he's Schlereth is amazing. Like, just an amazing dude.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm enjoying seeing Danny succeed the way that he's succeeding.
Lunch ball. Those are delicious. I love lunch balls.
I mean, I guess technically we could start the show and it's lunch ball. And then by the end of the show,
dinner
it's
ball.
5 o'clock hour is dinner ball.
Uh-huh.
Supper ball.
That's even better.
Hey, your first afternoon show food drop is happening Thursday.
Oh!
Rinaldi's is starting Detroit-style pizza.
Let's go!
Getting their launch. Or Highline, I guess. Highline Pizza, one of their other partners. Detroit-style pizza with Wani on Thursday.
Whichever one they want. It's fine. How about
speaking
that?
Speaking of lunch, dinner ball.
Yeah.
Dinner ball mm-hmm. is right. I love that.
Lawrence, you were going to talk about something, and then chaos ensued.
I don't mind. This is what I was telling you guys.
Welcome to the afternoon show.
That I don't mind this. Like, this is okay. As long as we can get the train back on track, it's good.
We got a break. Too bad.
It's too bad. Now we have to go to no. We don't. So I wanted to talk to you about this because there was something that caught my ear when folks were discussing it. They were talking about it on the post-game show. And we were talking about it as a group. The station has been talking about the idea of what the issues are for short yardage plays in that fourth and one play in particular. Like, if you look at the plays before that, where You have guys missing blocks where maybe on the direct snap, Herbert scores if it isn't a complete whiff on a block. There's a lot of issues. And I kept hearing Olin Krutz like in my head and him talking about in those situations, don't think about plays so much. Think about players. Think about who are your best players and how can you get them involved to get them to the place that you want to go. And then I saw a tweet from Matt Forte. And Matt has been talking about this for years. Someone who played running back for a long time.
Really, really good weapon as, of course, a receiver out of the backfield. But he knew how to run behind an offensive line, how to pick his spots, how to be aggressive when he needed to and go through the hole, how to wait and use patience, how to read his offensive linemen.
And that it can be problematic when you're running out of the shotgun or the pistol. And one of the things that he said about it in the tweet was pistol runs, shotgun runs are for elite offenses. In short yardage situations, those are for elite offenses. He talked with Dan and I about why he doesn't like this. Listen to what he said about it.
I've never been a big fan of short yardage gun runs. If you can spread them out and you can get a six-man box, that's cool, you know, because basically, you know, you run over one guy or make a miss and you got a chance to get a yard and a half or 2 yards or whatever, but you're still running sideways. I think one of the things that they have to take into account is that, you know, Mr. Fields definitely can run. So when we're doing gun runs, giving him that option to pull it does take an extra guy out of the box. And that makes some of those inside zone runs when you're in the gun a lot easier. When I was we were running that, you know, Jay would pull it every now and then, but he wasn't a big runner, you know, as far as doing that. Now when it's an obvious one and the end is crashing down and there's like no room, yeah, he'll pull it. But, you know, you can't guarantee or make – you're not going to make your bread and butter, especially on short yardage situations.
What a great point about the quarterback needing to be a legit run threat. If you are running from the shotgun, you're doing the zone read where the quarterback can have the choice, similar to the option where the quarterback can have the choice, he better be a legit run threat, and that's not Caleb.
Well, and early in Jay's career, I don't know if you guys remember that game where Jay was with Denver and they played against the Bears at Soldier Field, where he was doing all sorts of cool stuff. And I remember being there going, oh, my God, I wish the Bears had one of those. And then, of course, they got that one.
But he could run and did run more.
I mean, Jay would lower his shoulder in a heartbeat. Like, he loved to challenge, but the point that you make is so valid, Speaks. The idea of running that play with Caleb, I think most of us would have, if you go through the sliding door and you say that it is Justin Fields running that play makes a hell of a lot more sense.
Sure.
It makes almost no sense short side with Caleb. And I'm not blaming Caleb. Caleb made the right decision and a business decision where he's looking and he's like, no, it's not going to happen for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pitch it and see what happens. But the penetration on that play was so pronounced that it had no chance of winning. But even the thought of it, I think, is problematic.
I love the listening to Forte say he doesn't like shotgun runs in short yardage. The Bears ran four plays from first and goal. All four of them was Caleb in the shotgun with three wideouts. To me, it's insane. But this is the problem. It has become the groupthink in the NFL. And the Bears got a groupthink offensive coordinator. Because, take a guess, what percentage of snaps was a quarterback under center in 2023, all across the league?
Percentage of snaps, quarterback is under center. I'm going to say 35%.
17%.
Wow.
And it has dropped precipitously since 2009, and even just in the last 2 years. 2021 was 40%. And it dropped down last year, less than 17% of snaps were taken under center. There were two quarterbacks last year who were not in the shotgun on at least 75% of the snaps. Jared Goff in Detroit, Kirk Cousins in Minnesota. That's it. Every other quarterback was in the shotgun on at least 75% of the snaps. This has become the groupthink. And so I can understand when you think about how pervasive it is now, you can kind of understand when you're an offensive coordinator, you think, if I go under center, I'm telegraphing run. And they're going to load up the box and put eight people or nine people in there. That's, I mean, I keep going back to that Sean McVay and Jared Goff combo the first couple years. Goff was under center all the time, and Todd Gurley was there in the backfield all the time, and they would pass from that formation. The threat of the run is no longer the default of offensive coordinators around the NFL. They use the threat of the pass to set up the run, and it doesn't work for everybody.
It's wild, too, Speaks, because this is supposed to be kind of the renaissance of the running back. And you see, like, some of them are out here making big plays and changing games.
And I bet this percentage of snaps under center is higher this year because of simply Harbaugh and what he's doing, right? And what Matt LaFleur has had to do with Malik Willis. I would hazard a guess it's higher than that percentage as of right now, because we are seeing a running back resurgence.
And honestly, I think that and the new system that Justin Fields is in, the Arthur Smith system, has him under center a little bit more.
The Ravens and Derrick Henry just jumped up with their run game with classic Derrick Henry and Lamar Jackson under center and them handing him the ball.
I know that whenever we start talking about problems for a team, one of the things is often move this guy to here, because that I get that that can be kind of old school sports radio and not always the best ideas. This has been my feeling for the last year. And if I'm wrong on it, I'm good with being wrong. But I feel like in short yardage situations in particular, to go back to the concept of players, not plays, right? To me, it's been a mistake that the Bears haven't teamed up Tevin and Darnell. Those are the two nastiest guys on your offensive line. I personally would like them to be next to each other, because if I get into another fourth and one situation, that's where, or I got four downs to get 1 yard. I want to go with those two guys. I want to run downhill with those two guys being in charge of it. Them being mixed up, and look, Jenkins ended up on his butt too.
Sure.
On the fourth and one play. But I think if you've got the nasty, make them the nasty boys.
I understand.
Put the nasty boys together so that you can get a yard when you need a yard.
I don't disagree. And I know Olin's been on that. Both of you have been on it. David Haw tried to get on it after week two, and Olin didn't let him. Said, no, I'm sorry, David. It can't be your idea. Here's the thing. They really think Nate Davis is a better player than Tevin Jenkins. They blew that signing in multiple ways, but they've abandoned the idea that you're talking about of Tevin and Darnell. They think Nate Davis and Darnell will be the nasty on the left side, or they thought it was anyway, and that's been proven wrong. But I think you're right, because then you would have at least an identity. You'd know, where are they going over short yardage? Because so many different times, especially against that bad run defense, it called for just line up and do it. We didn't see the I formation even once. I know Blasingame is hurt. Cole Kmet could be that fullback or the H-back in the I formation. They didn't do that even once. I mean, it's so disappointing what Waldron has done and what Poles has done in regards to the possibility of them adjusting the way they need to.
And I do think that it's an NFL problem. I do think that, and the statistics that you brought to the listener, whew, I think bear it out. There are a lot of people who share the same philosophy of Matt Forte, of running out of the gun, like, or even pistol, but running out of the gun specifically, where your first step is lateral. It puts everyone at a disadvantage instead of hitting it. You know, as Dina would say on her video, sometimes you just gotta hitting it. That's hip hop. And just get right downhill. That's what I struggle with in modernized football. It doesn't mean that you can't go back, especially in those gotta have it situations, but you also have to practice that. You also have to draft to that. You also have to put free agents in a position that can do that. And I'm not sure that the Bears have done all of those things to get them that 1 yard that they need. Let's take a break. When we come back, there was some good on Sunday. Let's celebrate Rome Odunze. You want to do that?
Sure.
Let's get the vibes good going about what Rome did and how good he can be. Spiegel and Holmes here with you until Cubs baseball on the Score.
Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on the Score.
Williams now looking deep for Odunze. He's got it to the 35. That's the big play Bears fans have been looking for. A gain of 45.
You know, those continue to build confidence and, you know, get the offense rolling. When people are making those plays and we're getting those chunk plays, it allows for, you know, us to, you know, be on the attack. And that's the most important thing. You know, it's never about, you know, waiting for what a defense is going to give us and trying to figure that out. It's about attacking them, attacking what they are trying to get done and, you know, exploiting them on that thing. So I think, you know, it steps in the right direction.
That's Rome Odunze. Caleb Williams said that in practices, he's been telling Rome that he's going to try to get him the ball because he knows that they have that connection. He knows that they can make plays together, and we saw them do that. Rome had a huge game. I think it could have been an even bigger game for him on Sunday.
Yeah, but there were some misconnections, right?
Absolutely. But I was glad to see him break out in a way. And here's what I like about Rome. I think that guy is respectfully competitive. And when the idea of being with DJ Moore and Keenan Allen came up, Rome was like, look, I'm not here to be someone's backup. They drafted me because they know what I can do. I'm going to learn from these guys. I want to play with these guys, but I'm going to get my opportunities and make the most of it. I like that. It wasn't disrespectful. It wasn't out of pocket. It wasn't a diva, but it was confident. And I like that about him as a player.
Yeah, though, and I like Rome a lot. I like his attitude. I like his commitment, his work ethic. There doesn't seem to be that quite over-the-top electric athleticism of, say, a Malik Nabers who jumped off the highlight reel even just this past week, or Marvin Harrison Jr., but Rome can do everything. It's kind of like the truth of the scouting reports that we heard seem to be evident, don't they? Like, Rome is really solid at just about everything he needs to do.
And he's a willing participant in the run game or blocking downfield.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that he did show us a little bit of the freaky athleticism in the Titans game on that go-go gadget play where the ball's tipped and he jumps up in the air and he snatches it down. Like, that was some crazy athleticism from him. But I think that they're still...
I'm sorry. Like, did you see Neighbors?
Absolutely.
I watched the highlight, every catch of Neighbors Day, and it's like, oh my God. Yeah, that's a taller Odell Beckham Jr. as a rookie.
Watching Keon Coleman last night was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm with you. I like Rome a lot. I'm trying to figure out this offense, how the idea was going to be DJ Moore on lots of short stuff and let him run, like bubble screens and like super quick hitters.
Run after the catch for him, and then your third down target was going to be Keenan Allen because he's such a great technician on working post-snap and changing his route if he has to.
He was going to be the dude in the middle running option routes with he and Caleb trying to read the same keys, and take a defender one way or the other and run a route and be open. Now they don't have that, so that's got to be Komet. For more often than not, it's been way too much DeAndre Carter. Way too much DeAndre Carter, in my opinion. And no, necessarily not a slight to him, but he's a good depth piece. But I think that's gotta be Komet. Because Rome is your big bodied X on the other side, right? That's classic Rome. Rome is kind of like your...
He is built up like a classic X.
He's like a DJ, your DK Metcalf from right. Waldron's offense last year.
Or a Brandon Marshall. You know, like, yes. Like he's built up like a classic X, but I think he's got more versatility.
I think he does too.
And that's what's exciting.
You think he should he be moved inside to some of those third down type situations?
I think he's going to be. I think that you're going to see all sorts of stuff with Rome as he... That's what I think is so exciting about it, is that I think you have a player who's got the ability to grow exponentially, that when you see that guy motioning in into the slot, that's scary for a defense because you've got that great power, speed, size thing going on with him. And to motion him into the slot puts you at a real disadvantage on who are you going to have to cover him.
Mm-hmm.
I think eventually teams are going to have to make choices. That guy that you brought up is really important to that. Cole Kmet. Here's one thing that the Bears did great offensively. They figured out that when the Colts were in cover two, Cole Kmet was a cover two beater. He understood where to get loose, and he found himself open quite a bit.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Lawrence, I think it's time. It's Tuesday. It's 4 o'clock. We've processed the game. We will more throughout the week, but it's time to lean in to the conversational elephant in the room. Justin Fields and the Steelers are 3-0.
Oh.
Lean into it. Let's discuss.
Okay, why don't we talk? You want to talk with the people about this?
Yeah, we. I know that you have thoughts. I know that I have thoughts. I know that the people have thoughts because they've been hitting me in every possible way that they could hit me across the face and the social media and the text line and everywhere. So let's go ahead and lean in to the conversational elephant.
312-644-6767, the topic that we dare not breach. Justin Fields is undefeated. Next on the score.